supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
The Diamondbacks 4-2 as Joe Blanton heads to Los Angeles. Game 2 happens at 7:05 this evening at the park. Doc Halliday's got the assignment tonight. And the Union meet the Impact in Montreal at 7:30. You're listening to WHYY.
Welcome to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, a timely topic. Tasteless tomatoes. What can you do if you put your heart and soul into growing homemade... What can you do if you put your heart and soul into getting homegrown tomatoes, but they lack flavor? There are some things you can try to improve the flavor before the end of this season. We'll tell you all about it. But mostly it's a phone call show, cats and kittens, and you know what that means. We're taking that heap and helping of your telecommunicated questions, tips, etc. at 1-888-346-9499. Leslie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thank you.
Well, thank you, Leslie. How are you?
Great. How are you doing, Mike?
I am doing just fine. Where is Leslie?
Leslie's in South Philadelphia.
What part of South Philly?
I'm in the Italian Market area.
Are you really, like on 9th Street itself?
I'm on 8th Street, so
okay.
Block away.
Yeah, well, you could throw a brick there.
I can.
All right. What can we do for Leslie just outside of the Italian Market?
I live in an apartment, a rental, and I'm on a corner space. And so my gardening is done all in containers on the corner, on the sidewalk. So, and it's all vegetable garden. So every day when people walk by, I get a few sticky fingers, and they take a lot of my produce, and I'm left with nothing. I'm kind of looking for options of what can I do to protect my produce so I can have it.
And do you live on the first floor?
Yes, first floor.
Yeah. Are you sure it's all people?
Absolutely. I used to have a yard, and I gardened back there, and I got problems with squirrels then. But here on the corner, no squirrel problems. With squirrels, they would leave little bits and pieces of the food behind. Here, it's just completely taken. And some neighbors have mentioned they've seen people poking around.
So you say it's like on the sidewalk. Is there a little plot of land you're growing in? Are these all containers?
All containers.
How come they haven't stolen the containers?
No, they have.
Oh.
I've even come outside to find a container knocked over where it looked like they might have tried to up and run with it, realized it was too heavy, and gave up.
Your choices are limited. Have you considered any signage?
I have. I've put nice signs up, and that didn't
work. Oh, no, not nice signs.
Oh, I put mean signs up, too. Very mean, and I mean... You know, kid-friendly because it's a populated area.
The first thing that comes to my mind, first of all, next year I want you to join a community garden. I want you to have your garden behind a locked fence and a gate. I want you to be able to eat what you grow. There are many community gardens in Philadelphia. You may have to travel a little bit, but if you're going to live in the same place, I definitely want you to join a community garden. It might not be a bad idea to weasel your way into one now. Get on the waiting list or sign up for a plot next year so that you are in a community that is protected. Now, I know there's a great one down on South Street. There's the Spring Gardens up in the Art Museum area. But you can get in touch with the American Community Garden Association. You can get in touch with the people at PHS, the Pennsylvania Horticultural Society. Philadelphia Green has a community gardening program. Mm-hmm. The first thing that comes to mind is to rig up a phony camera and put up a sign saying, "Smile thief, you're on video." And I also know what, for like, $20, you can probably rig up a real one with a wire that comes inside your computer, and you can videotape these people and have a record of them. The other would limit your enjoyment, but it might be highly effective when they plant evergreens in public roadways and by the side of the turnpike and stuff, evergreens that could be used as Christmas trees.
Mm-hmm.
They spray them with a foul-smelling substance, and they will put up a sign that says, warning, these trees are sprayed with a foul-smelling substance. You could buy some deer repellent made with putrescent egg solids and go out and really saturate your garden with it so that it obviously smells, and then put up a sign, these vegetables have been sprayed, caution. And they would smell it if they came in and disturbed the plant leaves. Then you would have to wash the fruits really carefully to get rid of the smell, or peel them, but it wouldn't be any danger to you. There's no physical danger. It is just a smell and a taste deterrent for deer and perhaps neighborhood vandals.
Yeah.
So those, you know, the long-term solution, if you're going to stay, if you like this apartment, you like the neighborhood, you know, if there's a community garden within walking distance, what do you think?
I would love it if there were a community garden within walking distance. I know there's one on Christian Street, but I haven't investigated much into it.
I think you should. Philadelphia is said to have more community gardens per square foot than almost anywhere else in the nation. So look into that, because this is going to get frustrating. And otherwise, the video camera with the warning, or spray it heavily with deer repellent with the warning.
Absolutely. I'll give that a try. I like that one.
Okay. All right, good luck, Leslie. I guarantee that every single listener out there feels bad for you.
All right,
Leslie, take care.
You too. Bye.
1-888-346-9499. Scott, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. It's an honor to talk to you. I'm calling you from Rosholt, Wisconsin, central Wisconsin. My question for you is, I just started dabbling in the square foot gardening.
Okay.
I have 5 or 6 of them built. A couple of them already done. I've replanted. I'm wondering, will I be able to plant garlic in those? Will it overwinter, or will it just get too cold above ground?
Well, you say the square foot gardening. So did you actually buy Mel Bartholomew's square foot gardening book, and did you make the little grids and improve the soil and everything?
I did everything. Everything he had in the book except the grids, because that was just kind of for looks.
Oh, good for you. So you're not an engineer. You're a normal person.
Yeah.
You know, most of his gardening theory comes from extreme compulsiveness in mathematics. But his soil improvement in those little beds is so extreme and so wonderful that you get really great results.
The weeding is, there's almost none. And the moisture retention is perfect. It's been a good experiment, and now I want to experiment with the garlic. But it's not uncommon for us to see 25 below in the winter, and I'm just questioning if that garlic's going to freeze out above the ground.
I think you are absolutely correct to be concerned. And one thing that I don't often make clear enough on the show is, it sounds like I tell everybody to grow everything in raised beds. And the truth is, raised beds are best for your annual crops. They are best for the plants of summer, your tomatoes, your cucumbers, your peppers, things like that. I grow my garlic in a raised bed in Pennsylvania, but were I as far north as New York State, I would be growing it in very good draining flat ground to get that extra level of frost protection. I would also plant my garlic more deeply. I tell people here in the quote Northeast to plant their garlic 6 inches deep. I think you should bury yours 12 inches deep. And I don't think there's going to be any trouble with the garlic sprouts finding their way above ground if your soil is nice and light and loose. And the only thing I would be concerned about is make sure the soil drains well. Do that same kind of soil improvement with the perlite and the soil-free mix that Mel espouses for his raised beds. But in this case, don't raise it, or just take one of your raised beds and, quote, flatten it out.
Okay.
But yes, you could use some extra frost protection. And when your garlic is in the ground, and this is a crucial part about mulching that I think many people don't understand. And of course, you're in a part of the country where mulching can make or break an underground plant that has to survive over winter, is I want you to plant your garlic relatively early. I'd like to see you get it in the ground by September 1st, for instance. Nice loose soil. If you don't want to go a foot, go at least 9 inches. Make sure the soil drains well. And then do not mulch it right away. Wait until your first hard freeze, when your soil freezes hard the first time.
Okay.
And then put down 1 to 2 inches of very well shredded fall leaves. Because what people don't understand, they think of mulch as like an electric blanket that's going to keep the soil warm. And of course, it can't do that, especially in a place like yours, where it's going to get down to 20 below zero. What it's going to do is keep that soil temperature moderately even at the soil surface, so that your soil won't be expanding and contracting and perhaps harming the bulbs or trying to force them up out of the ground. And you'll get your best garlic harvests in years where you get good snow cover. When it starts snowing, if you get a good snow cover, and if that snow cover stays on until spring, then you're going to have a fabulous garlic harvest, because then the best insulator in the world of underground plant parts is a steady snow cover. Your big fear would be a year where it gets really cold, but you don't get snow.
All right, thank you for your wealth of knowledge.
I hope you're going to grow garlic, man. There's no going back. It's the greatest plant in the garden.
I will do that. Thank you.
All right, thank you, sir. Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will appear at the Green Fair at the Silverside Church in Wilmington, Delaware on Saturday, September 15th, talking about garlic, pansies, and other fall crops at 10:30 and compost making at 12:30. But don't go looking for all the details at the events and appearances section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what you can do now if your tomatoes lack good taste. I'm Tasteful Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Tasteful Garden.
Burpee supports You Bet Your Garden. Burpee is having an open house at their historic Ford Hook Farm headquarters in Doylestown on August 24th and 25th, featuring garden tours, guest lectures, and tomato tastings. Details at burpee.com.
You're listening to WHYY.
St. Francis Hospital supports WHYY. When a heart attack happens, the faster the blockage can be opened, the less likely permanent heart damage will occur. St. Francis's cardiovascular team has worked to reduce the time it takes to get a patient from the ER to receiving life-saving catheterization procedures to 50 minutes or less, versus the 90-minute national average. More at stfrancishealthcare.org. At St. Francis Hospital in Wilmington, we specialize in you.
If you have to travel on a budget this summer, here is what not to do.
Buying the plane ticket that's $30 cheaper, that has 2 stopovers. So you spend a full day traveling. You really need to decide what your time is worth to you on vacation.
I'm Tess Vigeland. Cheap travel traps and how to avoid them. Next time on Marketplace Money from 8 p.m. This afternoon at 3 on WHYY.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, what to do if your tomatoes, your homegrown tomatoes that you put so much of your heart, soul, and sweat into, just don't seem to have the right flavor. Is there anything you can do this late in the season? Yes, there is. We'll tell you what you can try when we get to the question of the week. In the meantime, lots more of your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Kelly, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Kelly. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good today.
And where is Kelly doing pretty good?
I'm in Oklahoma City.
Okay, very good, very good. What can we do for you?
I had some really bad luck with my seedlings this year, and I was wondering if you could help me figure out what went wrong.
Absolutely, it'd be my pleasure.
I've always started them in a 50-50 mix of potting soil and vermiculite.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay, good, good.
It always worked for me. But this year, I didn't have any vermiculite, and I used half and half peat moss and potting soil.
Oh, bad mistake.
Okay, well, they seemed fine. And when they were about 3 weeks, I think they were about 3 weeks old, I can't quite remember, I was cleaning out my worm in, and I had some extra worm tea, and just poured a little on my seedlings. They probably didn't really need that, but it's always good for my houseplants.
Mm-hmm.
And after that, they were just kind of stunted. They didn't go, nothing happened. And I didn't know if they got fertilizer burn from worm tea, or if the combination of worm tea and peat moss didn't work too good together, too much acidic something. Sounds like you have some ideas about where I went wrong.
Oh, yes, yes. Now, most of your potting soil mix, if it was a good potting soil mix, probably already was peat moss, but it was treated with lime to bring the pH up to neutral. Peat moss by itself is highly acidic. If you live in an area where the soil already tends to be acid, peat moss alone will allow you to grow great blueberries, which typically grow in soil so acidic it would hurt your finger if you stuck your finger in there with a cut in it. So
I should tell you, I start my seeds in this little mix, and once they emerge, then I take that, the root ball, the whole, all I can get, and transfer it to a larger container with just potting soil. So by the time these little plants were up, I mean, yeah, there would have been some peat moss there, but then I would have been pretty much normal potting soil, which makes me wonder what might be wrong with my worm tea.
Oh, well, but you said your plants were only about 3 weeks old?
I think so. I don't remember exactly. But they weren't too terribly big.
Right. The rule is not to feed your little seedlings anything until they're about 4 weeks old, until they have several of their true leaves, because the seed itself is mostly food. Any seed, most of the bulk of the seed is food. The genetic material that makes up what kind of plant it's going to be is a minuscule amount. And I presume you put all the normal stuff into your worm bin, you know, coffee grounds and kitchen waste, and you mix a lot of shredded newspaper or something in there for bedding?
Yeah, I have a lot of shredded leaves. I save them in the fall. Although, this last fall, I broke my arm and I purchased some coconut fiber bricks, like, so I don't have any way of knowing. And then, but there's a lot of onion skins, you know, banana peels, apple cores, and yeah, a lot of shredded paper too.
The only thing I can think is if everything else went well, that you simply fed them too early. And one thing I have to remind myself, because I have a worm condo, a stackable bin, so I've got I've really got four worm bins on top of each other. And I do have a spigot at the bottom, and I pour enough liquid through the worm bin to keep it moist that I get about a quart of worm tea a day in the season. And a lot of times I'll start to use that on plants, and I'll go, no, it's too dark, and remind myself of the old rule that you're supposed to thin it out until it's the color of weak tea. So I'll take that quart of worm water, so to speak, and I'll pour it into a gallon watering can, and then I'll like the color, and then I'll take it around and give all my tomatoes a little boost or something like that. But, you know, in one sense, I think your use of the term fertilizer burn is probably correct here. Even though it was a natural food, if you used it undiluted, it was probably pretty powerful. These worms really produce, you know, enormously beneficial worm castings and worm tea. And I think you just fed your babies a little too early and sent them into shock.
Okay, that sounds very possible. So now I know what to do differently next year.
All right, Kelly?
Great, thank you.
All right, take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Andrew, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hello.
Hello, Andrew. How are you?
I'm doing great.
And where is Andrew doing great?
I am in Freehold, New Jersey.
Really?
Yes.
Bruce Springsteen territory.
Hometown.
Yeah, very good, very good. I have friends who have a home in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, and I recently spent time there and on the Asbury Park Boardwalk. It's beautiful these days.
Yes, it is.
So what can we do for Andrew in Freehold?
Well, it's actually not in Freehold. It is Andrew in Maine. We are moving, and we have a property that we found in Cumberland, Maine, near Portland. And it is a beautiful house and a small little yard, which is perfect, and a big property, about 3.5 acres. It is a wooded, heavily wooded property, and it's got second growth pine and birch all over it. It's very thick and dense and not very usable. What we'd like to do is find a way to re-tree it, for lack of a better word, and put some hardwood trees in there to have them a little more spaced out, and, you know, have this be a nice long project for us.
Well, how old are you, Andrew?
I'm 40.
I don't know, man. they say you plant trees for the next generation.
Okay.
But the first thing that comes to my mind, that if I were moving from anywhere to anywhere, New Jersey to Maine, the last thing I would want to do is reconfigure a forest. Were you hooked on terraforming in the old Star Trek movie or something?
It's just that the property very obviously was not always wooded. There are some old stone walls on the property line,
really?
So that, yeah, that seem to be used for pasture or old property lines. So it's very obvious that this was planted. You know, these trees were planted when the houses were subdivided and built.
Right, but it sounds like a somewhat natural forest has sprung up, and I would think that it's doing a tremendous amount of good, you know, controlling soil erosion, food and habitat for wildlife, and producing a lot of oxygen.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people dream of being able to buy a place with woods, and I will reveal that our home is only an acre and a half,
mm-hmm,
but of that, a solid acre is very dense woods. And the only thing I ever did with those was cut some paths through them so the kids could go to the back of the property when they were small and do water reclamation projects where the two streams came together.
Hmm. So you don't think putting in larger trees and spacing them out is of any use to us?
Well, certainly if you find the area too crowded to use, and by using, let's just say that you want to be able to walk through the property, you want to create some walking trails or something like,
yes,
that.
That would be,
you know, you could continually harvest some trees that didn't appear to be healthy. Or if you're going to do any kind of wood burning for heat, you know, mature hardwoods that are ready for that, or, you know, look like they're about to come down anyway. But the difficulty with taking out trees and replacing them with other trees is that that's a project that can be done. But to do it, you need to remove the stumps and the roots of the old trees.
Right.
And that gets prohibitively expensive, and I really don't know of any way that a regular human can get a tree stump out of the ground. And not that 40 is old. I mean, I'm half again as old as you. But even at 25, that's a month's worth of work and aches and pains that you will die with. Pulled muscles that will follow you for the rest of your natural life. So the issue with taking an area like this and playing checkers with the trees is for every tree that you would hope to plant, you would probably have to pull these enormous root systems of perhaps four trees to get your new tree in.
Mm-hmm.
And to have it professionally done, we're talking thousands of dollars.
Sure.
Yeah, a tree. And I don't think, depending on the area, they would allow you to drill deep holes and dynamite them out.
No.
Neighbors
would object.
But what I would suggest is, first of all, get your house in order. You know,
yeah,
don't do anything right away.
And figuratively and literally.
Yes, don't do anything with the landscaping either for a year until you see the change of seasons and
mm-hmm.
you see what kind of perennials and bulbs and things you have around. And then work outward from the house. Improve the area around the house that you're going to see. and then come up with a plan. And I think it would make tremendous sense to selectively clear trees and create pathways, to create walking trails, mm-hmm. at the same time allowing more light and air for the existing trees. It sounds like this is a mismanaged area, so I can understand your inclination,
mm-hmm.
but it's going to be enough work for you to grind the stumps down to ground level to where you can walk easily. So I think you can achieve much by selective removal. It's the case with a lot of old gardens, man.
Okay.
You do better work taking stuff out than you do putting new stuff in. So as a whole season progresses, get to know these trees,
mm-hmm.
and decide which ones you want to grow old with and which ones whose removal will not only give you more access but facilitate the health of the trees that you want to keep.
Okay.
And I just saved you $1 million, 18 pulled muscles, and years of misery. But the final advice is go slow and then plan this big thing and think small. Always think small in cases like this.
Baby steps.
Yeah.
Okay.
All right. Good luck in your great adventure, man.
Thank you very much.
All right. Take care.
All right, bye.
1-888-346-9499. Michael, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, thanks a lot for taking the call.
Well, thank you for making it, Michael. Where are you?
I'm calling from Newtown, Bucks County, Pennsylvania.
I know the area well. What can we do you for?
So I'm a homeowner, and I have a line of arborvitaes in my backyard. There's 7 of them in a row. They are about 10 to 12 feet tall,
mm-hmm.
and they had been doing great. Now I have an infestation of bagworms.
Oh, man.
And one of the trees in the row is almost totally destroyed. I'm pretty sure one tree is beyond help. I don't think we can save it. And I don't see as many of the bagworms or any of the bagworms on some of the other trees. And I've already sprayed twice to no effect.
Well, did you use BT or did you use a chemical insecticide?
I'm afraid I used a chemical insecticide that I got at like Home Depot.
Yeah.
And it specifically said, you know, one of the pests said that it works against was bagworm.
Well,
that's why I try it.
That's just EPA approval. I wish you had gone to our website and looked up through the A to Z answers the question of the week on bagworm.
Okay.
Because they are a caterpillar pest, like tent caterpillars or fall webworms. They are caterpillar pests that infect trees and set up housekeeping in trees. Now, bagworms are the worst, and they often go unnoticed for years because, as you now know, their, quote, bags look like little pine cones. They look like a natural part of the tree. It's a good camouflage. But because of the shape and form of their nest, the bagworms are protected from sprays like you used. But the beneficial insects are very vulnerable. So it is not unusual to spray a chemical insecticide in a situation like this and make the situation much worse.
Right.
So
right.
The organic option of choice is BT, the oldest form of BT, BTK, which is sold under brand names like Dipel, Thoracide, Green Step. It's available at virtually any independent garden center or nursery, probably not the big box stores so much, although maybe I'd be surprised. And it's very safe because it only affects caterpillars who chew on the sprayed leaves. And bagworms do their damage in two ways. First, the silken thread that they use to attach their bags to the trees is stronger than steel. And it actually girdles that limb. So I also want you to contact your local county extension office in Bucks County and ask them when the bagworms feed in your area. The bagworms do not come out of their protective shell except for a limited time. But that time is very predictable, and everybody will know it. And a single spray with BT around the time that they emerge from the bags to feed will kill every bagworm, every caterpillar that you have on those trees without doing any other damage.
Oh, that's great to know.
Are the trees fed or mulched?
No, you're probably going to correct me, but I actually have, like, small stones around the trees.
I don't think that's good for the trees. You're alkalizing the soil. You're making the soil more alkaline with the runoff from the stones. If you want to save the remaining trees, get rid of that stone, find a nice source of yard waste compost, and use that as a mulch an inch deep around your trees. And whether you see anything or not, be prepared. Have the BT in hand next spring. Know the emergence time and simply spray the trees with the BT. You can't do any harm, but you can get rid of caterpillars that are so small that you won't even be able to see them yet.
All right. That's great.
All right, Michael?
Yes. Thank you for the help.
All right. Good luck, sir.
Okay. Bye now.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and remind gardeners having a great season that local food banks would love to receive some of your largesse to help feed hungry families. The Delaware Valley's biggest food bank, Phil Abundance, collects fresh produce from local gardeners at a dozen sites every Saturday morning. They and other food banks around the nation would love to get your surplus squash and excess eggplant into the hands of the people who need it most. But don't go looking for the food bank locator at our website just yet, because we'll be right back with more of your fabulous phone calls and what to do if your homegrown tomatoes lack that flavor you've been longingly looking forward to. I'm Mike McGrath, and this is You Bet Your Garden.
Burpee, a national supplier of seeds, plants, and bulbs, supports You Bet Your Garden and reminds growers that now is the time to start fall crops like broccoli, cabbage, and cauliflower, and to get ready for garlic planting. More information at burpee.com.
This is WHYY. It's 11:38.
The Pennsylvania Academy of the Fine Arts supports WHYY. Continuing education at PAFA offers art classes and workshops for all ages and levels this fall, including figure drawing, portrait painting, bronze casting, silk screen printing, and more. Featuring pre-college Saturday classes for high school students, art appreciation in the PAFA Museum, landscape on location at historic Yellow Springs Chester Springs Studio, and a masterclass with noted artist Bo Bartlett. Classes begin September 13th. For details, pafa.edu/ce.
This blended table follows You Bet Your Garden here on WHYY. And then at 1 on today's Fresh Air Weekend, former supermodels Beverly Johnson and Carol Alt talk about aging and what they did to succeed in the fashion industry, like virtually starving themselves. We'll also chat with Timothy Greenfield Sanders, director of the new HBO documentary About Face, in which Alt and Johnson appear. Join us for Fresh Air Weekend at 1 today, WHYY.
Announcing the 2012 WHYY Connections Festival, September 6th through 9th. 4 days of free arts and culture events, including an outdoor concert featuring Yola Tango, Frank Turner, Maps and Atlases, and more, Saturday, September 8th. And on September 9th, performances by Fred Parris and the Five Satins, Charlie Gracie, and more at the Philadelphia Doo-Wop Festival. More artists and events to come. Visit whyy.org/connectionsfestival.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden. I'm your host, Mike McGrath, and we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. What can you do if you have the heartbreak of tepid tomatoes? Your homegrown tomatoes don't have that fabulous flavor you were hoping for. It's not too late in the season to try to make things better. We'll tell you what your options are after a couple more of your fascinating phone calls. At 1-888-346-9499. Vincent, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, sir. Where are you?
I'm in Yellow Springs, Ohio.
Okay. Is that just outside of Dayton?
Yes, sir.
All right. Very good. What can we do for Vincent in Yellow Springs?
Well, I'm on the full frontal assault team. We call ourselves the RKOH, Relentless Killers of Honeysuckle.
Oh, yeah.
What we want to do is clear out the riparian corridor along the Little Miami, 200 feet per side. It's a daunting, arduous, huge, to say a couple things about it, but we're making a big dent. The thing I want to know is, right now we're using glyphosate. I'm not real crazy about it, but it's effective. And it's 20% glyphosate, 2% pentobarc. It's like over 90% kill rate. But my question, Mike, is there something as effective but less toxic we could be using?
You're working near water, so there's nothing more foul that you could be using. Roundup research by Dr. Rick Relia at the University of Pittsburgh, to me, has clearly shown that Roundup, which is glyphosate, kills amphibians, kills frogs and toads, and you're talking about working in their breeding grounds.
We're stump treating it with the
Yeah, but still, it's getting into the environment, and I worry about that. And I also worry about this war on invasive plants in fragile areas. What are you doing to prevent erosion once the honeysuckle is gone? The honeysuckle, yes, is an invasive plant, but it's holding that soil in place. It's providing food and shelter for wildlife.
It's kind of a catch-22, but...
Why does the honeysuckle have to go, other than the fact that it's on this list that somebody put together?
Well, it's a monoculture it's creating. We're trying to reestablish diversity and flora, and then fauna will come in after that, as the theories. We're seeing some things coming back, but...
The answer to your question is to, especially if this area is wet, is to cut and recut the stumps themselves. There's really nothing you can add to a stump like this other than poisons that's going to kill the root. But if you go online, you'll see a lot of techniques of cross-cutting, of taking the plant parts that are left and cross-cutting them with a chainsaw to increase the moisture content, to invite in insects that eat wood and that help the plant rot naturally. I can't think of a single thing in the organic arsenal, maybe iron. There are new herbicides out that are formulated with iron. And
iron.
If you had to try a substitute, I would suggest trying some of them. But there are also tools for people like you that can remove the entire root system. Have you ever heard of the weed wrench?
These things, some of them are like 50 years old.
Oh, I know. I know. It's a bad name. The weed wrench was actually invented for getting massive invasive root systems out of the ground. And I would like you to take a look at that. But I would also urge you not to do this work during the rainy season and never to clear an area without replanting it first. I terribly worry about erosion and damage caused by well-meaning people who are trying to do the right thing. But I fear that these are the plants of our future, and most of these reparation projects I've seen fall apart and wind up just causing more damage. And, you know, good people like you expend a lot of energy, and it's kind of like fighting the future, I fear. To me, a plant is a plant. Every plant has a purpose. Every plant has a usefulness. And if it's not even immediately apparent, it'll become apparent through evolution. I realize I'm probably not giving you the answer you want, but this is a response that I've kind of come up to after 10 years of answering this question.
Well, appreciate your information, Mike, and thanks for adding my phone call to your heaping helping.
Yeah, well, I can tell that you have a good heart in this. I can tell that you're doing the right thing. I wish you luck.
All right, thanks, man.
Okay, take care.
You too.
1-888-346-9499. Carrie, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Carrie. How are you today?
I'm very hot right now.
Well, you could be almost anywhere in the country except Northern California then. Where
exactly.
Are you?
We're in Oklahoma City.
Oh, I'll bet you're hot. Yeah. It's been a tough summer for you guys, hadn't it?
Yes, it is, but we're looking forward to rain tomorrow. We have a chance, so we're excited.
All right, good for you. We're pulling for you. What can we do for you?
Well, I have hydrangeas. We bought endless summer hydrangeas last year. We moved into a new house to us. We planted them last year. They were beautiful, lots of bloom.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't do too much fertilizing, just watering and things.
Right.
And this summer we had a few blooms come out in the spring, and they were pink. They weren't blue.
Mm-hmm.
And then after the few in the spring, no more.
Yeah.
Even before it got hot.
I understand. Were they containerized plants that were already in bloom when you put them in?
A couple of them had bloom.
Right.
One of them did not.
Well, I have nothing but good news for you.
Okay, good.
It is not unusual for nursery stock like this to be so forced, to be so overloaded with blooming chemicals and growth rate chemicals, because they want them to be showy, and
Right. They
want you to see them, to buy them, and then they want them to perform real well that first year. But it is not unusual for plants like that that are bought in bloom to be just exhausted the second year.
Okay,
and
that makes sense.
This is not at all uncommon. It typically takes a couple of years for blooming shrubs to get well established in the landscape. And when they're bought at full size, at blooming stage, I'd say more often than not, you have a tepid second year. And you've not fed them anything at all.
Well, my husband did feed them when I mentioned concern of no...
It's always the husband, isn't it? And
really, it was just Miracle Grow for blooming shrubs.
Yeah, that's probably in your soils in Oklahoma, which are massively alkaline and very poor. Chemical fertilizer like that, cheap chemical fertilizer, can really knock a plant down. Especially,
oh, really?
Yes, because it's cheap explosive chemical salts. If it wasn't in that Miracle-Gro box, it would be in a munition shell being shot at the enemy. And these chemical salts dehydrate plants. And you know, you live in a climate that already is doing that for the plants. So that's the worst thing he could have done. If you have access to any yard waste compost, you know, made from fall leaves, they would love a mulch of compost around their base. And they would also like, even on top of that, in the fall, get a leaf blower that has a reverse setting. Use it to shred the leaves, and then make a nice mulch of an inch of shredded leaves around the base of the plant. Because we want to keep moisture in the soil, and we want the soil temperature to stay kind of even over the summertime.
Right.
Don't do any pruning other than removing the blasted flower heads if you don't like what they look like.
Right.
In the spring, do you want blue flowers?
Yes.
You get a big bale of peat moss, milled peat moss, and spread that around the base of the plants. That will give the soil the acid component you need to make the flowers blue. If you do this every spring, you'll note that you can get good at it. You can get pink flowers on parts of the plant, blue flowers on parts of the plant. Sometimes when I fool around perfectly, I'll get flowers that are a combination of pink and blue on the same blooming head. And after the flowers bloom, then you can go in with pruners and remove the shoots that are blocking your view of the flowers.
Okay.
That's the best way to prune hydrangeas, is after they form their blooms, get rid of the non-flowering shoots that are blocking the view. You do that, and you'll have good shows. But the bottom line is, this is not unusual for plants that were intensively grown and forced in their second year.
Okay. All right. Good. I was worried. I thought we were going to have to replace them all.
No. It's quite possible that there's absolutely nothing wrong. The poor things are just exhausted.
Okay, great.
All right, Carrie?
Thanks very much.
My pleasure. You stay cool this summer.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Can tasteless tomatoes be made tasty? And before our producer Alexis Landis reads this week's question, I will mention this is not the question of the week we had previously promoted, but this was so timely when it came in, we rushed it into play. And we'll have those other questions of the week we've promised you before the month is out. All right. Alexis Landis, producer of You Bet Your Garden, read this week's oh-so-timely question.
All right. Bob in Newfield, New Jersey writes, I've been growing vegetables in raised beds for the past couple summers. This year, our tomatoes don't have the great tangy Jersey tomato flavor they've had in the past. Before I planted, I rototilled in some compost and used Osmocote fertilizer. Any idea why the flavor is different than in the past?
Well, tomato flavor is largely dependent on variety. Some varieties are bred to produce that great flavor people recall, while others sacrifice some of their flavor for traits like disease resistance and early ripening. So my first question to Bob is, what varieties are you growing? But two things in his email confuse me. One, why would you ever till a raised bed garden? Tilling causes nutrient loss and promotes weeds, and we design raised beds so that we never step on the soil in the growing area and thus never have to till. Fresh compost should always be added on top of the existing soil in a raised bed. And two, why would anybody use that cheap chemical fertilizer? That alone will knock down some of the flavor.
Bob responds, my wife is standing here laughing as I learned two important tomato growing lessons. I tilled because I thought mixing up the compost and topsoil would make a better blend, and I used cheap chemical fertilizer because I hadn't yet read about the natural alternatives at your website. And I'm afraid I don't know what varieties I'm growing. Some are supposed heirlooms from a big box store whose tags are long gone, and others were given to me by a friend. Thanks for any help and advice you can provide. I really enjoy your show.
Well, Bob, hopefully the varieties you're growing are capable of producing good flavor, which in tomatoes means the right combination of sugars, acids, and the volatile aromatic oils that give the fruits their distinctive smell and taste. But next year, don't leave it to chance. Plant for flavor. In a taste test conducted by Organic Gardening magazine back in 1995, the legendary heirloom variety Brandywine got the highest score of any tomato tested. Other high-scoring varieties included Prudence Purple, Dinner Plate, Oxheart, German Johnson, Evergreen, Black Prince, Green Zebra, Cherokee Purple, and Amish Paste. But you're currently stuck with your unidentified orphans, so let's see if we can increase their flavor potential no matter what they are. First, use no more chemical fertilizer. It increases the water content of the fruits and thins out their flavor. Remove any existing mulches and add an inch of the finest compost you can find. Yard waste compost is ideal. Well-aged mushroom soil would also be fine. But don't use biosolids or other euphemisms for sewage sludge. That's treated human waste from a water treatment plant. And let's add some calcium. It enables tomatoes to develop the highest amounts of the volatile aromatic oils that give the fruit so much of their flavor. And it helps the plants better regulate their water uptake, which enhances flavor by limiting the amount of water inside each fruit. And it prevents problems like cracking and blossom end rot. Many nurseries and garden centers carry a premium bag compost from Coast of Maine that's made with lobster and other shellfish waste. Feeding or mulching your plants with such a compost would be a great way to add calcium and other important nutrients. Now, typically, I advise people to save up their eggshells over the winter so they can add a dozen crushed shells to the planting holes of each tomato to provide calcium at the beginning of the season. But it's obviously much too late for that. It might even be a little late in the game to use one of the granulated natural plant foods designed for tomatoes. They all contain added calcium, but it takes a while for granular fertilizers to have an effect. So if you can't find lobster compost, dissolve a dozen calcium carbonate tablets in a watering can and water your tomatoes with the calcium-rich liquid. Repeat this nutritional watering in 2 or 3 weeks. Make sure there's a good organic mulch on the surface of your beds to regulate the soil moisture. Compost or shredded leaves are ideal. Wood mulch is the worst. Whatever you use, don't make it deeper than 2 inches. And when you water, water deeply for a few hours once or twice a week. and don't water if you've had a good soaking rain within the last 5 days. And finally, time your harvesting for maximum flavor. Tomatoes should be picked when they're just fully ripe or very close to ripe. Do not let fully ripe tomatoes sit out in the sun. They can lose 30% of their flavor in a single day. And when tomatoes come inside, store them out in the open at room temperature, not in direct sun or in the fridge. Heat or cold can dissipate their flavor. And pick those love apples first thing in the morning. Cool nights concentrate the sugars in all produce, and a tomato picked at 7 or 8 a.m. will have more flavor potential than the same tomato picked at 7 or 8 p.m. Well, those sure were a lot of hopefully helpful hints for people whose tomatoes lack good taste, now wasn't that? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website, where you can read it over carefully and plan your tomato flavor rally in the night. Just click the link at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Yikes, my producer is threatening to coat me with Osmo if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, you're tired, you're poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please tell us where you live, put the actual subject in the subject line, and check voiced to see if the information you seek is already waiting for you at our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you can click through to the question of the week. Find the solution to hundreds of garden problems, hint, hint, just like yours, hint, hint, in our Garden Answers A to Z section and or listen to this show, listen to old shows and or download this week's podcast. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our engineer this week is Fred Snyder. Our webmaster is Baneful Rich Banowitz. His faithful internet companion is Sarah Kazar. Our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work at our brand new Facebook page. You might even like it. Hint, hint. The always tasteful Alexis Landis produces You Bet Your Garden for WHYY-FM in Philadelphia. The undiluted Kelly Haggerty is our production assistant. Helping out this week is Joanna Hotzis. Our esteemed editor is lobster-loving Al Banks. I'm tasteless Mike McGrath, but I'll cultivate some culture by listening to a couple episodes of Fresh Air, and then I'll see you next week. It's almost time to get your garlic in the ground. I'm Mike McGrath, and on the next thrilling episode of You Bet Your Garden, we'll reveal how to grow great garlic and how to best use this year's harvest. Plus your fabulous phone calls.